that metaphor of traveling through a land of plenty and starving to death, it's a metaphor for who we are today. I think our culture's in trouble. We don't know who we are. And all around us are these native people that know who they are, that have things to offer us. And I think that to continue to starve ourselves and not borrow some of this knowledge, it's completely stupid.
Welcome to Sacred Land Speaks, where we dive into the audio archives of the Sacred Land Film Project and revisit the interview clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we bring you my 2018 interview with author and publisher Malcolm Margolin, who passed away last week from complications with Parkinson's disease. With Malcolm's sudden passing, it's a sad time for California's native people who've lost an invaluable ally and an inspiring storyteller. Indeed, many of us are grieving the loss of a dear friend. Since this is one of the last interviews with Malcolm before his ability to speak declined, we're releasing this podcast episode ahead of schedule to honor his legacy and celebrate his remarkable life. For more than five decades, Malcolm Margolin, with his long gray beard, was a fixture at the heart of Berkeley's intellectual community. As the founder of Heyday Books, he was instrumental in publishing hundreds of titles. Most significantly, in 1978, he wrote the groundbreaking book, The Ohlone Way, Indian Life in the San Francisco Monterey Bay Area. Reading The Ohlone Way when I moved to California in 1978 was a key to understanding the deep natural and human history of my new home. That book was a revelation for many of us. Ever since his introduction to the indigenous peoples of California, Malcolm was involved in cultural revitalization projects, including Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, California Indian Basket Weavers Association, and Heyday's magazine, News from Native California. In 2018, we collaborated with Malcolm's latest nonprofit creation, the California Institute for Community Art and Nature, and UC Berkeley's Phoebe Hearst Museum to host an event at the Berkeley Art Museum so that members of the public could view what archaeologists call the artifacts that were taken a century ago from the West Berkeley Shell Mound and stored in boxes in the Hearst Museum's basement. At the time, we were 2 years into supporting Lejan Ohlone leader Karina Gould's fight to protect the site of the very first village on San Francisco Bay, which was inhabited by Chichenyo-speaking people for more than 5,000 years. The burials and shells that remained beneath the surface were threatened by a luxury condominium development. Malcolm dreamed up this event to raise awareness about the threat to the Shell Mound site by celebrating the human artistry created there over five millennia, history that few people in Berkeley were even aware of. A standing room only crowd turned out. We documented the event and made a short film called Our Story Lives Forever, which included just one short clip from our interview with Malcolm. I'm pleased to share our whole conversation now. I began by asking how he came to write The Ohlone Way.
I ended up settling into the Bay Area by accident. I needed a place to live. My wife and I had been in a VW bus for a couple of years. We'd been living on beaches in Canada and Mexico. And then Ruben was born in 1970. So we needed a place for him to be born, and we settled in Berkeley. And I didn't like Berkeley very much. I thought it was a college town. If I was looking for spectacular scenery, I would have been settled in the Rockies. If I was looking for great beaches, I would have settled in Canada. There was something about that mix of bookstores and culture and easily available natural areas. It seemed like a place to settle. So we settled here. So this was the 60s, and I was eager to escape. I was eager to escape the East. I was eager to escape my background. And I was eager to escape my culture. And there was something about the Indians stuff back then where it was soon after Alcatraz, and every household in Berkeley had a picture of Geronimo or a Curtis print, and KPFA, the radio station, was broadcasting all this stuff. There were all these wild people, and there was something about it that was so attractive, but nobody knew anything about the Indians of the Bay Area. So in 1974, I needed a quick book to write. And I had enough money to live for 6 months. So I figured I'd write a book about the Indians of the Bay Area, who I thought were all extinct. I gave myself 3 months to research and 3 months to write. And I sat down to write this quick book. And 3 years later, I finished a book called The Ohlone Way, because I had a lot to learn. And that learning was revelatory to me. I think I got into it by accident. If somebody told me that I'd spend 3 years writing a book about these local extinct Indians, I never would have started. But I got into this because I was a delusion. It was in a way, a get-rich-quick scheme. Like all my other get-rich-quick schemes didn't work. But you know something about that. So I ended up writing this book. I thought it was going to be library research. But in the process, I began to meet people. It's the people that stunned me.
Through the stories he heard from the people he met, Malcolm began to piece together the larger story of the Ohlone people, who are actually 50 related tribes spread around the Bay Area, speaking 8 distinct languages, who are all lumped together and called Ohlone by colonizers. Phil Galvin was one of Malcolm's first important teachers.
He was an Ohlone Indian guy. He lived down in Fremont. And he was one of the most stunning people I've ever met. He was a mission Indian. He grew up in the village called Alisal. After the missions collapsed, the Indians settled in this village in Sinol, and they reconstructed the roundhouse. It was where Corinna Gould's, I think it was her great-grandfather, was Jose Guzman. He was one of the last speakers of the Chechenyo language. He lived there. Harrington visited this place, the anthropologist, and it was a center for culture, and it was a center for a dying culture. So Phil was a mission Indian, and ironically, the Indians that were part of the missions were much more in touch with their heritage than the Indians that weren't, because out in the dominant culture, there was no place to be an Indian. In the mission, you could be an Indian, but it was degraded, but at least your Indianness was acknowledged. So consequently, a lot of the people that hung around the missions had a much better idea of their background than the people that emerged into the dominant society. The dominant society was out to crush them and kill them and convert them. The missions, the fact that they still existed was something to the glory of the missions. And a guy like Phil Galvin had a lot of stature because he was a Catholic, and consequently he was allowed to carry his Indianness with him. What Phil knew was just magnificent. When I first wrote The Ohlone Way, KQED wanted to interview me. So I suggested that we go out to Coyote Hills, which is a East Bay Regional Park District in Fremont, where some naturalists had reconstructed a village. And I suggested that if they want to know something about it, the early days, they get some of the Indians involved. So I got Phil's family to come, and Rosemary Camber's family. And Thursday morning, the cameras are rolling up, and the Indians are late, which should be no surprise. And then a half hour later, about 20 cars pull up, and all these people get out. There must have been 40 people that got out, and the kids and old people, and they're walking across the hills. It was amazing to me. It was just like the old days coming back to the village. And I remember we were sitting in this roundhouse, and Norm Kidder was a naturalist. He's a white guy for East Bay Regional Park District, and he knew all the technology. So we're in there, and the cameras are out there, and he's starting a fire with a stick. And the Indians are looking at this. They've never seen anything like this. And one of the Indians says, I thought you rubbed the sticks this way. And another guy says, do you want a Zippo? And the Indians are a little bit chagrined that they don't have the technology. But what they had was something that was stunning to me. They had the family relationships, the way the young people were relating to the elders, the way the elders were talking. The structure was intact. And it was the most beautiful structure I could ever imagine. And there was stuff that was living there, that was embedded in their way of seeing things, that was embedded in how they talked to one another, that was of another world. Then later on, I began to meet people that were outside this area. Wallace Burroughs and Mabel McKay. And there was this marvelous old woman, Georgina Trull. She was an aristocratic Yurok woman. And she spoke the high Yurok, the aristocratic Yurok, which was different from the common people's Yurok. And there were all these magnificent people, Elsie Allen, Laura Somersall. They'd grown up in the 1880s, 1890s. They were born at that period of time. They were raised by aunts and grandparents that remembered California before the coming of Gold Rush. I could never conceive of people like this. And they broke my heart. They were so beautiful.
In the last few years of his life, Parkinson's disease affected Malcolm's speech. When we recorded this interview 7 years ago, his lifelong eloquence was just beginning to suffer a bit of a stutter. But let's get back to the interview. While people often say history is written by the victors, Malcolm was writing a history of loss. And his elegant prose celebrates human resilience under duress as it challenges the paradigm of manifest destiny.
We live in a triumphalist culture, and this triumphalist culture shows us winning all the time. These people had not won. They'd lost something big. And I think there was something in coming to terms with that loss that deepened their humanity and made them understand something in life that American culture will never understand. It's what it is to be ultimately defeated and to lose so much and how you cope with it and how you get beyond it and how you get beyond this material world, what your abiding values are. And the values were so magnificent. There was the sense of family, the sense of landscape, the sense of a way of viewing each other, a sense of community that was amazing, and a sense of diminished individuality. So the individual was not very important, the family was important. There was a complexity of ownerships and property rights that was wonderful. And there was stuff in there that was so amazing to me, and these people were so vibrant and so alive. For me, one of the most disgusting things about Trump is his emphasis on winning. And I think that there are more important things than winning in this world. And I think it's something we can learn from Indians. This whole business of making America great again is so reprehensible. If you talk about winning, you're just talking about life as a game, and life is not a game. Life is something else. And I think we have to get to this other sense of what life is all about. And we're not going to get to it through winning. We're not going to get through it through losing either. We're going to get to it by following an artistic way, by following a spiritual way, by having something that is different. For me, it's embedded in the Indian world.
I've felt many of these same sentiments during my 40 years of working with indigenous people, collaborating to tell their stories. So much of what Malcolm and I were trying to do was to translate for a non-native audience. But the difference between Western worldviews and indigenous worldviews is so huge that I often struggled to understand so that the translation would be accurate and hopefully helpful.
Today, I think that ideas have a kind of dress code. And to work in the family of ideas, you have to dress like other ideas and look like them. So Indians have cast their culture looking like Western culture, except with certain differences. I think it was profoundly different. And I think that these people were not going around thanking Mother Earth all day long, like modern people are doing. It was embedded in there. There was a gratitude. But they lived in a world of poisoners. They lived in a world of fear. They lived in a world of aliveness, and you have to be profoundly respectful of the powers of land and the powers of other people. And it was that respect that I think made things move along. And yet that respect was not embedded in love, it was embedded in fear. And I think that fear was such an important thing, and I think that it's been diminished. It's difficult to talk about it. And I'm a little bit conscious of talking about it and being recorded right now, and it's a little bit risky. But I think it was there, and what it was a tribute to was the aliveness of the power of the land around you and the sense of consciousness of that land, the sense that the land had spirit and had the ability to change you. I had a wonderful friend, Bun Lucas, and he was a Kashaya Pomo guy. Bun and I would go off on trips, and whenever we went off on a trip, Bun was always weighed down with amulets, because he was going to other Indians' territory, and he didn't want to be hurt. And so we went to see other Indian roundhouses once. We took a tour of California to look at roundhouses. I think what he was after was a grizzly bear pelt. I once asked him, I said, in Kashaya there was a story that people could turn themselves into bears, and they proved this by, they turn into a bear, and then a half hour later they come back with stuff from the coast. They come out with seaweed and abalone and stuff like that. As a human, it would take you hours to get to the coast, but as a bear, you could do it in a half hour. And I said, are there still bear shamans? He says, nowadays we have cars. But I think what he was looking for, that bear skin, it may have been potency that he was looking for.
Malcolm was drawn to the strong sense of humility among the Ohlone people he met,
There's a sense of uncertainty that you get from these older generation of Indians, where this, the sense that they have is that the world is bigger than our capacity to understand it. So we have the sense that human beings can understand everything, that we can go out and pursue knowledge and get it. With Indians, the sense of the world was it was big, it was mysterious, there were things we don't know about. And maybe if we're lucky, the world will give us a gift of this understanding. And I think there's something in that uncertainty that I just love. You'll talk to an old Indian and he'll say, who made the world? And he'll say, maybe it was Coyote, I think. It's not the certainty that it was Coyote. It's maybe it was Coyote, I think. And then you'll say something like, the people in the next village said it was Silver Fox. And the Indian will say, well, did they say it was Silver Fox? Here we say it was Coyote. In Europe, you would have had a religious war in which 3 million people would be killed to figure out whether it was Silver Fox or Coyote. There, it's not important because the world is an inherently mysterious place. It's inherently unknowable. And your place in it is not fixed. You don't have rights in the world. The world is a gift. And I think, for me, the gift of the world is the sense that the world is not owned by people, that we don't have rights to it, that it's a gift to us, puts us in our place. And it's a beautiful place to be in. I think it's a truthful place to be in.
And from that truthful place, Malcolm gained a deeper understanding of what it means to be human.
One of the main things that I've gotten out of hanging out with Indians for the last 50 years has been a sense of the greatness of people. I've met people that are so amazing in their forgiveness. People like Daryl Wilson and Frank Lupina, these people that grew up under the worst of circumstances, boarding schools, dysfunctional families, taken away from their culture, and instead of producing hostile people, it managed to produce people of such sweetness of soul and such capaciousness of understanding and such a belief in the world. I don't understand how this happens, but I've seen it, and it makes me proud to be a human being. I think hanging out with Indians has made me proud to be a human being. And there are things in my own culture that make me proud to be a human being, but I find hanging around some of these people that are so fully formed and so resilient and so truthful in their way of being and so humorous that for me it's class A human beings. This business of casting Indians as victims is one of the worst things we can do to them. I think what we have to concentrate on is the revival of culture, the survival of people, their bravery, and I think this business of casting them as victims is really unhealthy. I'm also struck by the generosity of Native people. I've gone to people's houses and I've been fed so luxuriously and I wonder whether it's their last grocery sometimes. And yet, there's something in that generosity that is so touching to me, especially coming from a culture that's so damn greedy and stingy. And there's something in the ownership patterns of Indians that I think we can learn a lot from.
So often when we're trying to help non-Indigenous people understand the significance of sacred places, it's hard to convey why specific places hold unique power and why a sacred site cannot be moved. Malcolm explained it well.
One of the things that I've loved about being around Indians is their sense of place and the sense that knowledge is too important to entrust with human beings. You embed the knowledge in mountains, you embed it in animals, and when you go out, the world tells you stories. And I go out with these Indians and that particular rock over there may have been a person in a previous lifetime. They knew the story of that rock. That particular place had powers, and this particular place had history, and there were these stories that were attached to place, and it gave you a sense of who you were. Animals had stories. When you heard mourning dove coo, you'd think of the story of mourning dove in the Yurok world, about how mourning dove in the previous world had been a gambler. And mourning dove was out there gambling. And they're playing Indian cards with the sticks and stuff. And mourning dove was on a winning streak. And somebody comes and says, your grandfather's dying. You better see him. And mourning dove says, no, I'll be there in a few minutes. Because he's winning, and he's got all these treasures piled up around him. He's got red woodpecker scalp, he's got abalone, he's got white deer skin, he's got dentelle, he's got all these marvelous treasures. And so finally the grandfather dies, And these ancient beings transformed themselves into animals. Morning Dove became the bird, and you can still see the treasures around its neck. And forever it has to coo in mourning for its grandfather. And when you hear Morning Dove, you think of that story, and that story tells you something. And what it tells you is that you have certain duties as a human being, and if you don't fulfill those duties, you're going to mourn forever. And when you see a particular rock, you know that you know the story of how the person was converted to that rock, and the land spoke to you. And when the Europeans first came, they erased the history of the land. They erased the names of things. They changed the names to Spanish names. They changed the stories, and we lost a tremendous amount. We tend to put forth, based on advertising and based on ideas that are coming at us all the time, to be a human being, you need a single family house with a lawn and a level of income. What we try to do is we try to create an environment to supply us with these things. I think what the Indians tended to do was, when they came to a place, they adapted to that place. And every Indian had a story of how their place was the center of the world. In the Mojave Desert, it's the most god-awful place I've ever seen. And you have creosote bush, you have a small variety of plants, you have a few starving animals, you have a vast portion of land, no water. The Mojave Desert is not one of my favorite places. For the people that lived there was a story of how World Maker searched the world for the most perfect place for people to live and found this place for them. And I think the sense of love of your land and knowledge of your land is so important. It's what it represents to me, is something of that sense of being.
Malcolm Margolin's superpower was that he was a great storyteller. He shared an account of the first contact between Spanish explorers and Bay Area Native people that captures the profound clash of cultures that continues right up till today.
When the first explorers came into California, the Portola Expedition, they're coming up the coast, they're starving to death. Their provisions are 5 moldy tortillas a day. They're beginning to eat the mules. Every morning before they left, the friars would say the Viaticum, which is a prayer over the dead, because they thought that somebody might die during that day. And all the time they're marching through this countryside where people are living in a land of plenty and feasting. And the Europeans refused to try this native food. And it wasn't until they got to Pacifica, where Pacifica is today, there's an Indian village called Puristoc. And the Indians saw these starving Spanish coming, and they gave them some food. The Spanish were suffering from scurvy, and they were eating these 5 moldy tortillas a day. And they were beginning to eat their mules. So they finally, in desperation, they tried this food, and they recovered. But I think that metaphor for me of traveling through a land of plenty and starving to death, it's a metaphor for who we are today. I think our culture's in trouble. We don't know who we are. And all around us are these native people that know who they are, that have things to offer us. And I think that to continue to starve ourselves and not borrow some of this knowledge, it's completely stupid.
At the time I interviewed Malcolm, we'd been supporting Lejean Ohlone leader Karina Gould's efforts to protect the West Berkeley Shell Mound and Village site for 2 years. Malcolm had convinced the Phoebe Hearst Museum to display some of the beautiful artifacts that UC Berkeley archaeologists had removed from the shell mound, necklaces and fish hooks, obsidian spear points and bone whistles, artifacts that Karina calls her ancestors. I asked Malcolm why it was important to save the West Berkeley Shell Mound.
If we can preserve that shell mound, it becomes a place that speaks to us. And the story, separate from the shell mound, it has a half-life. I think the stories need places to embed themselves in, to give them reality, to give them some kind of sense of rootedness in a particular place. And without that, you end up having generalizations. You end up having ideologies. You end up having dogmas and tenets. I think Indians had the sense of place that was so powerful and so beautiful. And each place was unique. And each place had its story. And each place had a complex of feeling. And I think that to preserve that shell mound as an idea is so attenuated, so skinny, it has no emotional resonance for me. To have it as a place where you go there and you feel that vibration, it's in this very place where something great happened, is the kind of thing that we need to make it real. I think the village site itself was 5,000 years old. So 5,000 years is a fairly long time. And I think that to see it in that length of time, to understand our history as not being something that was only a couple hundred years old, to see it going back that time gives a whole new sense of what it is to be human. I think you see changes in that period of time that were immense. You see the bay changing in that shell mound. You see the waters rising and falling. You see climate change. You see changes of vegetation. You see, and what you learn is people adapt to change. And I think our culture has to know this.
Malcolm and I shared a singular challenge during our decades-long friendship, and it's what brought us together to work on the Shell Mound campaign. That challenge was how to convince non-Indians, in this case Berkeley citizens, to care about a sacred cultural site about which they knew very little.
We need these places to tell us who we are and to tell us that Berkeley is not just a place that began 200 years ago when white people moved in, but it was a place that had existed for a long time. We primarily have to preserve it for Native people because it's their sacred land. And it's their burial grounds. It's their history. And they have ownership of it. But I think we also need it for ourselves. There's something about the shallowness of our culture that disturbs me greatly. It's so recent that white people moved in. When I was a kid, I grew up in Boston, and there was this house in our neighborhood that was owned by the Field Sisters. And the Field Sisters were Civil War spinsters. So many people had died during the Civil War. They were these unmarried women, and they still lived in their old family house. And it was in the middle of this ghetto-y slum where they lived. But they remember the Civil War. And when I was a kid, the Civil War was still a living memory. I was once talking to Millie Fields. I came home from school. She says, "What are you studying?" I said, "The American Revolution." She said, "When I was a kid, I knew people that remembered the American Revolution." So that brings us back to 1776, which is the foundation of Mission Dolores. Our culture is so recent. We're talking about me reaching back to Millie Fields, reaching back to somebody else, three old people. It's hard to base a sense of life on such a short period of time. And I think what the Shell Mound teaches us is that history is much longer. And I think it allows us to see change. If we can understand that the past was different from today, we can envision a future that's different. That, for me, is what we need, is a sense of the future.
I asked Malcolm to elaborate on the difference between the sacred places of mainstream faiths and those of land-based indigenous people.
Indian religions are completely different from Judaism and Christianity. They're based on place, and the place has power. Christianity, Judaism, Muslim world, their religions have been packed for travel. So the religious ideas are in dogma and tenet and books and ideas, and this can survive place. With Indian religion, it's place, and that place has the power. It speaks to people. They go there, and it's a different kind of power. It's people understand that, they can understand that power and live by it, and it's not well articulated. So I think that if we lose it, what we lose is a sense of a place that can change with people, that grows with people, that people can relate to. It takes it out of the world of living practice, and it puts it into the world of frozen ideas. And I think what we have to do is keep these things alive. And to have a place where Indians can still go, where the culture can evolve, in a place where it had been evolving for 5,000 years, it would be a great gift to Indians, it would be a great gift to us all.
Today, what remains of the West Berkeley Shell Mound is a 2-acre former parking lot surrounded by an upscale shopping area. Settlers during the Gold Rush leveled the massive shell mound to fertilize farms and pave muddy streets. The Ohlone were in hiding, still recovering from being enslaved in Catholic missions and hunted during the Gold Rush. But they never stopped coming for prayer and ceremony at the place where 100 generations of their ancestors had lived and died. Malcolm explained why it was important to protect the site and help win the land back to Native control.
From the very beginning, people tried to make Indians invisible. When the Spaniards renamed the landscape, it was the first step in taking the stories away from the land. And over the years, Indians have been rendered invisible. And I think that there's racism, there's economic oppression, there's slavery. These things were terrible. But I think when you render people invisible, it's hard for them to do anything. And for me, having a prominent place in Berkeley, its prominence is what strikes me. It's not just giving them a little cabinet in a museum. It's not just giving him rights to have an event at the senior center once in a while. It's having this prime piece of real estate that's given over to Indians and for their prominence that I think it's worthy of pursuit. Because I think we need this to make an impact on us. And we need just not throwing people a crumb of attention, not just giving them some leftovers, but giving them the main course so that we can come back to it. There are things about the Shell Mound in the village that are so goddamn beautiful it will break your heart. There's pain in this story, but there's also beauty. The Spanish started the process of erasing the Ohlone and making them invisible. You can overcome racism, but it's hard to overcome invisibility. These artifacts coming out to breathe is a beautiful story.
Bringing Ohlone artifacts out of the museum basement gave them an opportunity to speak to us in a different language, a very old language.
For me, one of the big changes I've seen in my life as a publisher has been the increasing use of salesmanship in our language. And salesmanship has affected our language so that we don't know how to talk to one another without selling something. It's embedded in our tone. It's embedded in our way of being. It's embedded in our grammar. And even now I'm trying to sell you something because we don't know how to talk otherwise. And I think that with that Indian world, there's something else there. And there's that marvelous poem by William Rowan, which says, I want to tell you of the forest, I'll have to speak in a forgotten language. And I think this Shell Mound and these Indians offer us that forgotten language. It's a language of art. It's a language of ambiguity. It's an embrace of uncertainty. There's something about that language which has a flexibility, a tentativeness, and a way of describing things that we need. We use language to conquer the world. We use language to define things. We use language as a way of getting power over things. I think Indians use language as a way of expressing wonderment and poetry and ambiguity. And for me, it's something we have to learn.
Malcolm had an interesting take on the role of stories in modern culture.
I think that we live in a culture where we have too many stories. And it's going to offend my colleagues in the humanities, but I think what we need is fewer stories that we know well. I think what binds a culture together is a bunch of shared stories of a limited number. And I think the story of the Shell Mounds now is competing with all these other stories around us. I think what we have to do is tell that story as well as we can and tell it in a way that it hasn't been told. It's been told now as a defeat. I think there's a defensive posture to it all. And it's justified because we're trying to save something. But there's something in that rhetoric that I think militates against its beauty. I think to view it as a holy place, to view it as something that reaches back in time, to give us a sense of this is something that we need for our own soul.
Many people are critical of the UC Berkeley anthropologists like Alfred Kroeber, who excavated the final remnants of the Shell Mound in 1950 and removed artifacts and burials. At the time, they thought they were preserving a dying culture.
And for me, this business of a dying culture is very important. I think this perception of Indians as dying out was something that motivated Kroeber. We were working with the Hearst Museum. I think the Hearst Museum was founded to collect stuff from a dying culture, to keep it around for scholars in the future. And when this culture refused to die, the museum is now struggling with how to deal with this. It's a momentous and a historic struggle. I love being part of it.
The pieces of Ohlone art that Malcolm was about to display were meant to inspire a conversation about the role of work in Shell Mound villages and the place of artists in different cultures.
So there are these old theories about shell mounds and people that were living on shellfish. And as part of our ethnocentric sense of the world, people that live on shellfish were considered lazy and mentally underdeveloped because the food was so easy to get. People that hunted were much smarter. And at the top of the chain were Brits and Nordic people who had rough climates and exerted themselves, and this was thought to build culture. The Mediterranean people had it softer, so they had less smarts, and Indians had it even softer, so they had no smarts at all. And I think this is such a stupid way of viewing things. It reinforces an ethic, a work ethic, that we live in our work, and it expresses a discontent with life. You have to continually prove yourself, you have to continually do stuff in this world. It leisures a threat. I think that Indians had a much easier life in some ways. What you have is a culture that was dominated by art. I think that they sacrificed a whole lot for art. The houses were made of tule. And what does this mean? It means that, on one hand, I think I would be very reluctant to live in a tule house right now. I'm getting older. The inconvenience of living in a tule house is too great. But what people are sacrificing for their houses is immense. In the Indian times, the tule was all over the place. Everybody had a house. There were no homeless people. The differences between the houses of the wealthy and the houses of the poor were minimal. And the amount of labor you put into a house was minimal. And so you had tons of time. And that time could go into basketry, it could go into dance, it could go into song, it could go into art. And that, for me, is what holds cultures together, is the stories and their art. And these cultures were held together much better than ours are. I think that the artifacts teach us a tremendous amount. Their beauty is so moving. And I'm not sure what beauty is all about. I think about it all the time. I wonder why it moves us so. I'm not sure whether it's seduction or whether it's excess power. I'm not sure what it is. But I see it so clearly in this culture. There's a mortar that was made, a mortar bowl, and somebody had shaved the sides of this rock. Hundreds of hours went into chipping this thing and then smoothing it out. And then along the rim of it, you have these little olivella shells were made and affixed to it. Why did they do this? It was not for survival. It was not for economic reasons. They did it because of this human urge to embellish, this human urge to make beauty. And I think this is such a part of our culture. It's the best part of our heritage. The dominant culture has taken beauty and has put it off to the side. The artists in Indian cultures are central to their culture. With us, artists are marginal. And they're given certain privileges. They can be outlandish. They can be like Andy Warhol. They can be like Picasso. They can take dope. They can live outrageous lives. And it's tolerated. In the Indian world, the artist was central to the culture. People like Frank LaPina, he's a dancer, a singer. And there's something so conservative about Indian art. These people are embedded in this society, and the art is embedded in this society.
At the museum event, Aztec, Mixtec, and Cherokee craftsman Fred Velasquez, who is a longtime supporter of Miwok culture, showed the audience some of the laborious techniques that would have been used to make the jewelry and everyday tools on display.
And depending on how hard and how fast you do it, it will begin to erode away little chips, little pieces of chips will start breaking off.
Malcolm saw artists as intermediaries, exploring a mysterious relationship with beauty.
So one of the things we're going to be seeing is objects of daily use. And these daily use objects, so much labor has been put into them, so much work has been put into them. And what does it say about people's sense of themselves? There's a pride of place, there's a pride of being human. My wonderful friend Dugan Aguilat was a California Indian photographer. He talked about not taking pictures, but pictures being given to him. I think there's several characteristics of Indian aesthetics. One of them is that the world wants to be beautiful and that people are there to serve the world in its desire to be beautiful. And that the beauty is inherent in the world around you. It's not part of your own humanity. That what you do is you go out and you make yourself available to the beauties of the world. And I think there's a passivity to that that's wonderful. It's not something that human beings are adding to the world. It's something that the human beings are drawing from the world. And your job is to be open to it and to receive it. And I think there's something in that that we have to understand.
To Karina Gould, the artifacts are ancestors. For Malcolm Margolin, they were ambassadors.
What I'm looking for is a dual way to open people's imaginations. And I think the battles we're fighting are won and lost first in the human imagination. And I think these artifacts are an entry to the imagination. I think if we look at these mortars, we can get a sense of that of the world. We can get a sense of the pounding of acorn in it, the rhythmic sound of that acorn pounding. We can get a sense of what it is to live in a world of faith, that the acorn trees will give you acorns every year, and a sense of human ingenuity and learning how to use them. What I see in those artifacts is something of the spectacular intelligence of people. When you're a modern person, a bow looks so easy, and it looks so primitive. If you've never seen a bow and an arrow, whoever conceived of making this thing and making it so brilliantly? The aerodynamics of it are extraordinary. Do you know why arrows are fletched with feathers? is to retard the motion in the back so the arrow will go straight. And sometimes the feathers are kind of twisted so the arrow spins. This whole business of the sinew-backed bow, sinew was glued to one side of it to give it more flexibility. And the aiming and the stuff around this was so magnificent. And it says something about human beings' ingenuity. It says something about human beings' capacity to be innovative. And these bows are beautiful. I tend to talk a lot about the virtues of Indian culture, but as long as you talk about them without any backing, it just sounds like bull. It sounds like salesmanship. And I think we live in a world in which we're trying to sell it. Everybody's trying to sell something. When I talk about Indians' culture as being valuable, it sounds like I'm selling it. When you look at these things and you see what they've made, it becomes apparent that there was value in there. And that value has to do with people's ability to relate to the world and transform it and be transformed by it. My wonderful friend Julia Parker was a basket weaver, and we were up at Hoopa Reservation once. And I was up there with her, and I'm looking out at the people that were there. And all the great basket weavers were alive back then. Vivian Hailstone was alive. Norma Turner was alive. Mrs. Finney was alive. Mrs. Sylvia was alive. So all these great basket weavers were there. And I look at Julia and I say, Julia, look, basketry has attracted the best people in the world. And she says, Malcolm, you don't understand. It's baskets that make us this way. It looks like people make beautiful objects. I think the beautiful objects make us. Working with beauty is something that transforms everybody. So what you see in these things is a hint of another world. And there's so little left of that world, that world of 5,000 years ago. It's a way of introducing us to that world. It's not just cerebral, it's not just theoretical, but it has some kind of validity to it.
Looking at the artifacts and learning more about all that it took to create each unique piece, I couldn't help but wonder about the people who made them.
There was no standardization back then. So everything had personality and power. Everything you owned had a history. And it wasn't like a tool that you bought in a hardware store that's like every other tool. Everything you knew where the material came from, you know who made it, you know how it was used, it fit your hand, it was part of your personality. And it was living in this world of deep knowledge of things and an attachment to things. I personally don't have much of an attachment to things, except what things that people gave me that have stories attached to them. This was a world in which everything had a story attached to it. Every arrowhead was made by somebody. Every bow was made by somebody. Every basket was made by somebody. And you knew who that person was. And I think when a person died, they often burned the stuff because it belonged to you, in you alone. I think we've degraded things in our world. For a culture that worships things, we've degraded them. And I think that this gets back to some sense of the beauty of the physical world. And we live in the physical world.
For my final question, I asked Malcolm what he thought the future should hold for the Shell Mound site.
It's not up to me to decide. It's up to the Ohlone people to decide. And what they will do is not what I would do. But as a Jewish guy from Boston, I don't have any right to tell them what to do.
Even though he wasn't trying to decide what should happen at the site, while speaking at the Berkeley Art Museum, Malcolm gave an impassioned plea to protect the West Berkeley Shell Mound.
This is our holy ground. To give it over to development is just so stupid. It's such a sin. It's such a short-sighted thing. And I think it's a place where what I frankly think is at stake here is Berkeley's soul. And I think that if we lose this, we lose our soul.
Fortunately, the West Berkeley Shell Mound was protected in March of 2024. The Segurite Land Trust, which Karina Gould co-founded along with Janella LaRose, with help from the City of Berkeley and the Catali Foundation, bought the land back for $27 million. The last time I saw him, 1 week before he passed away at the age of 84, Malcolm had just listened to this podcast episode. I asked him what he thought, and very clearly he said, I loved it. Did he want anything changed? No. I hope you enjoyed it as much as he did. To watch the short film about the museum exhibit, Our Story Lives Forever, visit the Sacred Land Film Project's YouTube channel. And you can visit sacredland.org to learn more about our films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. Tune into the next episode of Sacred Land Speaks for part one of my interview with Native Hawaiian activist Deviana Pomakai McGregor, where she shares the story of how the Protect Kaha'olawe Ohana stopped U.S. Navy bombing of a Hawaiian island and regained sovereignty over sacred land. If you like what you've heard, please rate and subscribe to Sacred Land Speaks on your favorite podcast app. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt Wong and Toby McLeod. Our interview and video footage of Malcolm Margolin was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger. Our theme music was composed and performed by Stefan Smith and Charles Johnson. And special thanks to the Executive Director of the California Institute for Community, Art, and Nature, Claire Greensfelder, for reviewing this episode. Sacred Land Speaks is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in the Lejeune Ohlone Territory of Huchyun, otherwise known as Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.